We are back on a Wednesday edition of the Dunked On Basketball podcast. I know I said that we were going to have additions the last couple of days. Unfortunately, I was not able to do that, but going back on your word doesn't really seem to bother people that much lately. So this will be the...
Wait, I thought we had a deal!
...edition of the Dunked On Basketball podcast. What's up, Danny?
Today has been wild. The last couple days were substantially less wild, but, I mean, we have a much clearer sense now of where things are going to be.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Obviously, if you haven't heard, you've been under a rock and haven't followed Twitter at all, in which case, what's wrong with you? But DeAndre Jordan is now officially back with the Clippers. A four-year, $87.6 million deal. Presumably the fourth year is a player option. So he'll be back in the market when he is 29. But obviously, I think the place to start here is what a disaster this is for the Dallas Mavericks.
And in some ways, for me, the biggest way it's a disaster is also the commitment they made to Wesley Matthews. Granted, the word commitment can be thrown around a little bit differently now. But whether you want Wesley Matthews or not, even is very, it kind of, to me, changes based on DeAndre Jordan.
Yeah, to me, there are a lot of prior sort of welching that was been talked about. There was the Antonio McDice in going to Denver from Phoenix, where they wouldn't let him into McNichols Arena. You know, they had Jason Kidd and a bunch of other Suns players trying to get in, and Nugget security wouldn't let him in while he was signing the contract. There's the Carlos Boozer thing was mentioned, Elton Brand in 2008, where he actually had texted Mike Dunleavy saying he was in to come back, and then he went to Philly.
Hedo Turkoglu?
Yeah, Hedo Turkoglu was another one who signed with Portland. I guess maybe the lesson for a lot of these is that and then Jason Kidd going back to the Mavs supposedly and then spurring them to go to New York. But the lesson I think on all of these, except for maybe Kidd, is sometimes you're actually like lucky on these. However, all those guys are kind of health risks or at least ended up being a DJ, basically never misses games. So you can't necessarily take much solace in that if you're the Mavericks. And to me, it's not only Matthews, because they made the offer to him and it supposedly was variable how much it was going to be based on whether DJ accepted or not. But the issue now is the opportunity cost of using the rest of their space. Everyone else is gone.
Exactly. And that's the biggest issue here, is that Dallas doesn't have they can't have a fallback plan because everything's fallen away. And there were some of them that they lost during the courtship of DeAndre Jordan. But now the market is really barren, and you have to start thinking about whether you really even want to start putting money down on this year, whether you want to use this as a year to build towards the future. And the other challenge with that is the obligation that they have to Boston because of the Rajon Rondo trade.
Yeah, Mark talked about in a somewhat celebratory interview in after getting Jordan that they weren't really sure what they were going to do. They might have had to take a step back. He didn't go so far as to say tank, but basically implied they would want to get a chance at someone who would be a great player in the draft. And obviously, if they're going to retain their pick to do that, that means falling into the top seven, which is pretty tough to do even when you just have someone like Dirk on the roster. Poor Dirk took way less, and I'm sure due to no fault of their own, basically, the Mavs management hasn't been able to deliver on that. And so I really think that what we've seen, this is just the latest example of it now, even though it took DJ a while to come around, is, look, having a bunch of space is fine. Being a so-called premium market is fine. If you don't have one of the best chances to win, you best not count on getting a premium free agent.
Yeah, and they actually, in some ways, did the template of how to build a smaller guy with Chandler Parsons, that they got him on that sort of a, not poison pill-y, but a difficult offer sheet. But that wasn't enough to sway this kind of a decision. You also had to deal with the fact that DeAndre Jordan, like a couple of these other guys in free agency, was having to choose from a place where he was already in a really good position. And so it isn't a situation where we'll see with some guys where they're not winning or anything like that, and so maybe they're looking for a change of address. DeAndre Jordan was on a team that, with him, will be substantially better than Dallas would have been with him.
Yeah, that's right. And I think as basketball fans, we should all be happy that this happened. If you are a neutral fan, you want to see another good team in the West. Now you can really say again that there are four great teams in the West. The Clippers now have unequivocally gotten better. You know, despite what I thought was kind of a weird trade to move on for Matt Barnes, who was a good player for them last year. They recovered by getting Paul Pierce for the MMLE. They picked up Wesley Johnson as well, who I think is going to be a very good minimum signing. Another guy who I think could help them, especially if he's used at the four as a small ball power forward, space the floor a little bit more, let them, run pick and rolls around, Blake or DeAndre on the second unit. And, you know, they're looking really good right now, having gotten those guys. And then, you know, Lance Stephenson, you know, I think you can probably argue that he at least has the potential to be a better player than Barnes this year, though, you know, maybe he won't be, and he doesn't have as much shooting. But now, especially since they have Pierce, you could see them going small more often. You know, they really only have kind of two legit big guys, so I think they will do that more. Lance's lack of shooting isn't as much of an issue, and his ability to drive to the basket is magnified. So I really like now what they've done, and you have to imagine that, you know, I don't know if I put them quite there with OKC, Spurs, and Warriors, if healthy, but not too much below.
Plus, if they want to, they could move Jamal Crawford for a big if they wanted depth at that position. Now, you're with a piece like Jamal, you're not looking for a starter. You're not looking for that. It's something much more manageable and a reasonable thing for expectations, because now that they have Redick, Paul, and Lance, they don't necessarily need those two guard minutes. I think it'd be worth it to keep him, but the value of him as an asset changes with this because their needs change.
Yeah, you'd have to imagine Big Baby will return now. I don't see him getting some offer that's so much more lucrative than playing with the Clippers, where he's already been for the last year and a half. Is, you know, if they just give him a raise off of his minimum, I think that's probably about what he would have gotten anyway. So that's, I could see him coming back there very easily. So yeah, I mean, the Clippers have got to be pretty happy. And so what do you do now if you're the Mavs? Are you going to rebuild completely? Do you tell Dirk, hey, I'm sorry we weren't able to do it for you. You know, if you want us to move you, we will. If you want to try and win another championship, you know, do you try to just put together the best team that you can for this year? What's your play if you're them?
They're also in some trouble. We talked about how, you know, there aren't ways to players to get, is that guys like Roy Hibbert, which would have been a more logical option for them, are also off the board. So when you end, we'll talk about it later, but David Lee. So my initial thought was to try to use their space as a way to squeeze some assets out of other teams in the way that somebody like the Sixers have done. But there aren't as many of those players out there now. You know, even that is a more limited market. So I think what you do is you kind of troll for teams that are underselling their assets. Let's say the Nuggets with somebody maybe like Wilson Chandler, Danilo Gallinari, maybe even Ty Lawson. You see if they're maybe looking to lower their own bill and maybe would take less for those types of players. Something like that might make sense. But in terms of signing players that are currently free agents, the market is pretty barren. They could also, I guess they could try to screw with Oklahoma City with an offer to Enes Kanter if they wanted to, but I don't know that it'd be worth it either.
Yeah, no, it doesn't necessarily seem that way. So, yeah, I think that, you know, and then tanking isn't that great either. Even if you put aside the interpersonal aspects with Dirk, you know, Wes Matthews probably wouldn't be too happy about it either. I mean, maybe you think of him now as just an asset. If, you know, if he really does sign for 4 for $47, which is the latest reported figure, is quite below what some of the other ones had been. You know, maybe you just say, all right, Wes, take your time coming back, make yourself look good by the end of the year, and then we can either try to use you in the rebuilding next year, or we can move you to pick up some more assets if it looks like you're really back. Because, you know, if they're going to really start rebuilding, it doesn't necessarily make sense for them to have him, you know, starting at age 29, you know, he probably won't be there. Maybe they think they can just have one down year and then reload around a high draft pick and, you know, it'd still be Dirk. I mean, part of the other problem is just Dirk isn't that good anymore either, you know what I mean? Which is to be expected at his age. But, you know, I think he really ideally would be more of like a third big, just because of his defensive limitations. And he's not really able to take advantage of guys one-on-one anymore either. And he's not really able to beat smaller guys. It's more just of a pure stretch four now. So, you know, when you consider all of that, I don't really see the path for them to make a run at it this year. And I think they run the risk of just, you know, getting the 10th pick or something and losing it to the Celtics. And then you really have a lost year. So I don't know what the heck they do. I really don't.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they're going to be able to get the Pacers to pull back on the Hibbert deal. I think that's the type of thing that would make sense for them. But even then, I mean, I can't see, we talked about this in other podcasts with other teams, but I don't see a path now for them to really be a playoff team in this West. You know, it would take kind of in a way more than a miracle considering the depth that is in that conference.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. So, without too much moralizing here, but you know, I think we should at least address it. What do you think of the fact that DJ basically just went back on his word?
I don't love it. I think that it, you know, that it, this whole structure, and you can talk about whether this is a good idea. This whole structure is built on verbal agreements. It's one of those things, and I from what it sounds like from the reporting, the Clippers really just reacted to him reaching out, which is a lot better. If it had been the other way, I'd have an issue with it, but. That's the kind of the connecting fiber of this whole moratorium structure. And if that breaks, even just in this case, that makes a whole lot of things more challenging to figure out. And you can say maybe that's not worth it, but I'm not super comfortable with that. But at the same point, me being uncomfortable with it doesn't matter at all because it's within the rules.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. It is within the rules. But I think you have to look at it from the perspective of the three parties involved here, which are DeAndre Jordan's agency, headed by Dan Fagan, that's Relativity Sports. It's the Mavericks and Mark Cuban. And then there's DeAndre himself. You know, I think that DeAndre himself is really the only one who can kind of get away with this. There have been other players who have done this in the past. They're just viewed as kind of less business-like, mature entities. And also, just one player for himself doesn't have an ongoing reputation that's so essential to uphold, right? So, all right, fine, DeAndre Jordan, and they also have skills that are so in demand if you're really good that it doesn't matter that much, right? Like, is anyone going to not chase after DeAndre Jordan in free agency 3 years from now, 4 years from now because he did this? Like, no, that's not going to happen, right? Fagan, on the other hand, you know, I think there might be an element where, you know, people might hurt his reputation a little bit. I think there have been some attempts now to kind of make it seem like, you know, this was all DJ going rogue. And I think that's probably correct, frankly, you know, to just that it's something that couldn't be anticipated. I mean, you never want to look like, I mean, as a lawyer, you know, we talk about something like, you know, you want to be, you know, have your client's wishes in mind, but you also want to have them in mind well enough that they're not going to be doing something that you don't anticipate so that you can represent them properly. And that's not necessarily what happened here for Fagan. There's some saying that, oh, well, you know, he was pushing him to Dallas because it's a favorite of Cuban and he couldn't get to White there and they have this nice relationship. And there was definitely some pushback on that too. I don't really want to speculate on what that is or isn't, frankly. But, and then the Mavs, you know, people are like, oh yeah, well, if it's okay for DJ to do this, like, would it be okay for the Mavs now to just back off on Wesley Matthews? And no, of course not, because the Dallas Mavericks make, you know, 10 to 15, or if not more, probably 20, 25 transactions with players every year, and their word has to mean something, not to mention when they're trying to do trades with teams. So, and they're trying to get guys in to work out. Like, you can't do that, you know? So as the player, you can do it. I mean, it's just from a real politics perspective, DeAndre can get away with it, and the other people can't.
The other component of this I wanted to talk about is, I think we both expected that one of the options on the table now with the Clippers was going to be a 1+1 deal or something to that effect. And while he didn't end up taking his full max, he took the 3+ a player option as opposed to the 4+ a player option. I still think that a 1+1 would have made some sense for him.
Yeah, it would have. I tweeted out during the day that maybe what the kind of trump card, which didn't turn out to be the case, I was just speculating and stated it as so, was that they might do that and then just say, hey, we will just for sure max you out next year. You know, wink, wink. This isn't necessarily legal, but that's what we're going to do type of thing. But, you know, and I still think of all the players on the market, he would have been the most justified in doing that. Although, you know, maybe you could say if you look at the 2016 free agents now with all the other players who didn't take the 1+1 this year, I mean, it's basically LeBron, who all would think would go back to Cleveland, KD, and then, you know, what else is out there from a superstar perspective? Not a lot. So I think DJ could easily have gotten a new max, you know, starting at around $25 million next year. But, you know, I think he just wanted a little bit more security. And I think the 4 year is relatively smart. He gets back on at 29 as a big guy. Hopefully he can re-up for another 4 years or 5 years at that point and really maximize his earning power under what will likely be a new collective bargaining agreement at that time.
Yeah, I definitely think there's something there. Also, a guy who's probably going to be a little bit happy about this is Al Horford, because I think now he's the marquee big man on the market next year. And granted, I think he was probably going to get a lot of money anyway, but I think it helps to thin it out a little bit.
So this is one thing I might consider if I were Dallas, and I might have even done this if I were Miami with Josh McRoberts last year as well, after LeBron didn't come. Although McRoberts actually, I think, ultimately signed to a pretty value contract. But what I might say to Wes Matthews is, look, we will honor our commitment to you, but if you want to back out, like you kind of signed on for DJ being here, we're going to have to go in another direction now. Like, you are welcome to back out. If you want to, we will let you out of that commitment. You know, we don't feel too bad about it because, you know, we're going to go in another direction. This isn't what you signed up for. So maybe that would happen. That's something that I would consider if I decided I really was going to try and stay in that top seven. But, man, what, like, still, I just don't know how you do that. They are just between a rock and a hard place now because they signed up Dirk and, you know, Parsons too. I mean, are they going to now, you know, at least they have kind of these injury issues with Matthews and Parsons, and Dirk, you know, maybe just who knows what they do with him. But, you know, it wouldn't be that hard to kind of just tank it this year. But, you know, again, I mean, just how do you sell that to poor Dirk Nowitzki, right?
Yeah, and Chandler Parsons has a player option after this season, so he could be a free agent next year too. So there's another thing to consider in this whole thing is, like, could you really be left with actually nothing?
Yeah. No, that's true. It's a very good point, although, you know, Parsons, we'll see if he even comes back well enough to where he would consider opting out of that, you know, $16 million or so that he's due the year after this one.
Well, considering what Wes got, I think he might as well do it.
Yeah, I guess that's true, right? I mean, an Achilles, probably people look at that as being even worse than whatever knee injury he suffered. So why don't we get into now some of the other signings that we've had since we were last on. But first, let's talk about probably the biggest news out of the day is that the actual cap is set. It's higher than pretty much anyone anticipated. In our previous projections, we'd been going off of Ken Berger's report that it could be between 68 and 69. So in our assumptions of how much room everyone had for these last few podcasts, we've been saying 69. Now it turns out it is a flat 70 million. And I think a lot of that is because the players didn't get as much revenue as they were supposed to. The players got paid back all the escrow money. For those who don't know what that is, 10% is taken out of every NBA player's paycheck to make sure that the players don't get too much money, and then, you know, and that their designated share, it's called, falls between 49 and 51% of BRI. And for, I think, the first time, an agent tweeted out that for the first time he can remember, the players got all that back, and their revenue was such a shortfall that they got paid another $57 million as well, which is distributed, I think, pro rata based on what their salaries are to all the players. So that shows you that the players didn't get paid as much as they were supposed to last year, and the mechanism for that to fix it in future years so they don't have to rely on the escrow system and just paying out checks is to increase the cap and the tax by more than you necessarily would have just based on the revenue. And I think part of the reason for that is you saw teams like Philly and
Orlando.
Denver, and who's the other
Orlando.
One? Orlando. And Orlando both actually fell below the minimum salary. And so they now have to pay out to their players We're not sure exactly what the formula is, but it's probably pro rata as well based on their salaries. The Players Association decides it, but I assume that's how they'll do it. They have to pay out money to their players as well. I think it's both pretty small, like both $1.5 million or less for both of those teams. So a little interesting stuff there with the cap accounting. Now, so the maximum salaries, we know what they are. For the 0 to 6 years, that's $16.4 million. $19.7 million for the 7 to 9 years experience. That's like the LaMarcus Aldridge, Kevin Love, Marc Gasol, DJ, Paul Millsap. And then for 10-plus experience, LeBron James is the only one who will be resigning for that. He would start at $22.97 million.
And those also affect guys who have trade kickers in their contracts, because that can go up to their maximum wherever that goes. So an elevated maximum could affect some players in trades during this season.
Yeah, that's right. If you sign for the maximum and then the trade kicker would put you over what the maximum is in future years, then you don't get all of your trade kicker. But now that the maximum has gone up so much, that trade kicker does actually kind of start to matter. As it will for Roy Hibbert when he gets traded to the Lakers. So who does this help now that this has come in higher than was expected?
There are a couple big groups it helps. One are teams that were over the tax. It lowers their bill because it, you know, pushes up the line, so that makes their bills less intense. So a team like the Nets. Another group are teams that were kind of close to either the luxury tax line or the salary cap. It gives them a little bit more breathing room. You could think about a team, maybe even, I don't know exactly with the Spurs, with how everything worked with them, but maybe. And it also, of course, it helps the players who were getting max contracts who aren't in the situation like Klay Thompson, who agreed to a number, not the max. And
you mean it helps the teams.
Helps the teams. Yeah, it helps the teams. Yeah. It helps players that aren't Klay Thompson. It does not help Klay Thompson.
Players on those teams now have more ability to spend, yeah.
Exactly. And so I think those are the big winners. Any other ones you can think of?
Not really. I mean, specifically a team like the Bulls, for example, might even be able to get under the tax if they... I don't think that they should from a competitiveness standpoint. I think they still should use the taxpayer MLE to add another guard. And we can talk about who that might be as we kind of get down to who's left now. That's a team, the Heat, another team that could save just from that $3 million that the tax line went up from the previous official estimate. You know, that they could save almost $10 million depending on exactly where their final team salary falls.
One quick thing on the Heat.
Brooklyn as well that you mentioned, but especially the Bulls, they might, and OKC too. This might actually help move those Enes Kanter negotiations along for Oklahoma City potentially, now that their tax payment might be a little reduced, because that's probably the biggest issue with them and Kanter right now.
Something I wanted to add on the Heat is that with Dallas losing out, they also now have another potential dumping ground for Mario Chalmers and or Birdman if they want to do that.
Yeah, no, that's definitely true. So speaking of dumping grounds, David Lee got traded to the Celtics for Gerald Wallace.
Yes, he did. So the numbers on this changed a little bit. I did a piece for the Sporting News, and if you count in both salary and the tax savings, if all they did was just salary for salary, that saved about $23 million. That changed a little bit with the new estimate, but let's use that as the rough number. But it also gives the Warriors the ability to use the stretch provision, which is something we've talked about before, because through a CBA quirk, since David Lee's contract was signed under the previous collective bargaining.
How much are both those guys making?
So David Lee makes a little over $15 million, and Gerald Wallace makes a little over $10 million. So a $5.4 million difference in salary makes a minimum of like a 20-something million difference in luxury tax payments under the previous estimates.
Yeah, and Boston may either have to throw in a non-guaranteed contract or two, depending on how much space it turns out that they would have had at the time they make that trade. They've got a lot of other signings and stuff that they have to make. The gyrations are a little too complex to get into here. But depending on how they do it, they may have to throw in someone like Chris Babb or Phil Pressey to make the math work, who Golden State probably wouldn't keep. But yeah, I'm sorry, so continue.
But yeah, and so the other component of this is that while David Lee's contract was signed before the CBA was agreed to and thus was ineligible to be stretched, Gerald Wallace's contract is eligible to be stretched. And so what that means is you take his a little over $10 million salary and you go over, for his case, it would be double the years plus one, which means three. So you take 10.1 about and divide it by three, and so put about $3.4 million on for the next three seasons. Cutting his salary from 10.1 to 3.4 saves the Warriors a whole lot more money because it moves them down a couple tax brackets, and it also puts them, you know, it saves about $7 million on this year's salary, though obviously they have to pay that in future years.
Yeah, so certainly I think this is quite a coup for the Warriors. Would you agree with me on that?
Yeah, they didn't have to give up any assets to do it.
Yeah, no, we had speculated that they might have to deal the 30th pick to just straight up offload the salary. And now, you know, the Warriors might be able to just trade Wallace away again. You know, $10 million is a lot more palatable than $15 million, especially if it's stretchable. They may not want to put more money onto 2016 and 2017 if they're hoping to make a free agent play, as has kind of been rumored for Durant. And you know, I'm not quite sure how they're going to be able to do that. We'll have to get to that at some point when we do a 2016 preview. But yeah, I mean, it's a coup for them. What is Boston doing though?
Early in this whole process, I thought about the idea of Wallace and Lee being components because at that point, Boston, I thought they kind of could use some depth and some maturity for their front court. But they signed Amir Johnson to a two-year deal with a second-year non-guaranteed. And that gave them a loaded front court already because they have Zeller, they have Sullinger, they have the aforementioned Amir Johnson, they have Kelly Olynyk. So I don't exactly understand it. I think you could make the argument that it's better to have someone than to have no one, because I think Gerald Wallace didn't really have a place on that team. But that's a lot to sacrifice for a player who doesn't clearly fit as a useful piece in your rotation.
He is really, though Amir Johnson can do it too. You know, he'll probably be the best pick and roll big man that they have. Although when you throw in a Linux ability to pick and pop from the 3-point line, maybe you might take that back. Yeah, I mean, they're basically just blocking Kelly Olynyk here, who I think is someone who might have a little bit of a future. And, you know, this will be Olynyk's third year. They kind of want to figure out what's going on with him to see whether he's going to be worthy of an extension or not next summer. And, you know, it just, I mean, I don't think David Lee's really any good anymore. You know, like he's has the ability to work in the pick and roll, but he's really almost more of a center offensively, especially now that his, you know, in terms of his shooting range, his jumper is kind of abandoned. I mean, he definitely has more ball skills than your typical center, you know, and ability to create off the dribble and use both hands around the basket. But in terms of shooting range, he's basically a center, but he provides none of those skills on defense at all. He's going to be a year older. I think he will get into a little better shape than he was in this year once he came back from the hamstring injury. But man, it doesn't really make much sense to me. I mean, maybe this makes them a little bit better this year. I'm not even sure that it does, but you're now blocking the development of Olynyk, and it's surprising enough that I never even thought of them as a potential lead destination. Let's put it that way.
Another issue I have with this is that we talked about how they have a loaded front court. They have a lot of point guards as well with the drafting Rozier and everything else. They have a weakness in my eyes at small forward and a little bit at shooting guard, and they're not really in position now to add pieces there. So they have blockages some places, and you could say, oh, well, they can move some to the other, but that's not really the way their talent is affiliated right now. I mean, do you really want to move Kelly Olynyk? Do you want to move Jared Sullinger? You just signed Amir Johnson. So I don't see how this shakes out, especially because David Lee's an expiring contract. So you're not sitting there going, oh man, in 2 years, like this is a great investment thing. In 2 years, somebody's going to be beating our doors down for him. It's a rental that doesn't make much sense. And they didn't use leverage because the Warriors saved so much money on this, and the teams that they had were drying up.
Yeah, I really don't get it, to be honest. I mean, the one thing that I thought of that it might be is he is a big salary that they could potentially use to, you know, as an expiring contract to take on bad salary from other teams. Or if they were to trade for a star, perhaps DeMarcus Cousins, for example. He would be a big salary that could go back to Sacramento that expired in that deal. And, you know, even might help them aggregate enough salary to where, you know, they could even take back a bad contract or two as well to help give salary relief to whatever team that they're trading for the star from. That's about it, though, that I see. I mean, you know, maybe he helps them, but, you know, is he going to be happy playing in a backup role there? I assume they brought him there to start. So I don't know. I mean, and you know, there's still Jared Sullinger there too. You know, he's another guy who I assume they're not going to reach an extension with, but, and you know, he can play a little bit. I mean, I don't like him that much just due to his conditioning issues and defensive issues, but he can shoot the three, he can rebound, you know, score inside a little bit, you know, not, he is a rotation player. So yeah, I don't quite understand it from Boston. And, you know, I haven't really been able to get a straight answer from anyone who's been able to address some of the concerns that I've raised either.
This trade also, in terms of the Celtics, would have been on the table for a while, and yeah, they could have seen if they could have done something more with their cap space. It ended up being that now they have more cap space than they
were. Yeah, I mean, they only had about $5 million left at this point, I think.
But, I mean, maybe you extract a better player from somebody. We talked about the guys the Heat are trying to give up. I mean, maybe you do that. And if you... I like your idea of using Lee potentially being a trade asset, but, you know, at that same point, Gerald Wallace is probably more practical, especially if you're going to keep some cap space. I mean, that, to me, that's a way to do it. But at the same time, you know, it's a strange move for the Celtics from the leverage perspective and from a talent perspective, but, you know, we'll see how it turns out.
All right, that's enough on that.
Yep.
Marc Gasol, the biggest guy, really, I mean, the best guy to sign since we last were on the air, quietly went back. You said, who reported it was a 4+1? I didn't see that.
I don't remember, but I saw it somewhere when everything came out.
Might have been. It would make sense.
Yeah.
That it is. So that's a 5-year deal though. That'll be for $113.2 million. And you know, he'll get 87.6 of that if he opts out after that fourth year. Probably would have to imagine that he would not opt out of $26 million in his last year, you know, when he's at age 35, he's 30 now. So great deal for him, great for Memphis, for him to stay there. I do worry a little bit, you know, we had talked about him taking the 1+1 because to kind of see where things end up in Memphis after this year and that, you know, it might be time for them to kind of break up if they can't make any inroads this year, but it looks like, you know, they're going to kind of keep things together. And I think, you know, they have Zach Randolph for another year now as well after this one. You know, Mark's there for another 5 years. Mike Conley will be a free agent after this year. They'll have to retain him. That's the next one to start sweating about. He'll be due for a very substantial raise. But, you know, this will be a telling year for Memphis, who I think is very firmly in the second tier, not the first, of Western Conference contenders now with the upgrades that, you know, some of the Spurs and the Clippers have made and, you know, with OKC getting back to full health and Golden State being so dominant last year. So we'll have to see this. This could be the kind of the last hurrah, or maybe this will show having just added around the edges and reloaded very well with Wright, who I think was probably the best MLE signing out there. You know, we'll see whether this is going to be a transition year for them or whether this is, all right, we can still continue to compete with this core. We'll try to keep reloading around them.
I still want to see if now that, especially with a little bit more flexibility, if they can make a move like trading Jeff Green for Danilo Gallinari. I think that would really increase their spacing and give them a more flexible option for a couple different positions. They could do something like that. And Memphis, yeah, I think tier two is about where I would put them too, as long as you're putting, would you put them in the same tier as the Clippers?
No.
Yeah. So depending on how you classify that. Yeah. And so, but however you want to classify it, that's going to be a rough group and it's going to be very injury dependent as well. And so, I mean, Memphis is well situated, but that's going to be, you know, kind of a minefield. But I wanted to follow up that you said that Marc Gasol was the best player to sign since the last time we talked. So you're not as high on Reggie Jackson as some people are?
Yeah. 5 years, $80 million with Detroit. I mean, Draymond Green has to just be like, you know, bouncing off the walls right now to know that he signed for $2 million more than Reggie freaking Jackson is, you know, what is he, like the 20th best point guard in the league? If that, you know what I mean? So what's the rationale? I know you had Feldman on your podcast. You know, he's always been a huge Pistons guy. Like, how did he feel about it? And what was like the rationale? Like, spin this to me from Detroit's perspective of like why this isn't as bad as it appears to be paying, you know, really when this much, when they had most of the leverage, not all the leverage in this situation, and just Reggie Jackson is not that great of a player.
It has to be based on what they saw both at him as a person and him as a player, particularly during that last, I think it was 19 games when he played very well. He has very good chemistry with Andre Drummond, and they feel that he can be maybe above that, you know, maybe into that 10 to 15 range for top point guards. And when you think about where salaries are going, you think about what a guy like Mike Conley is going to get next year, maybe... I can't even keep going with a straight face. I mean, it's something to that effect. But as soon as I started bringing up Mike Conley, I actually put my hand on my head and just said I can't keep going.
Would you care to guess what Reggie Jackson's career 3-point percentage is?
32?
29%. He did up it to 33.7%. In his 27 games with Detroit, you know, not a large enough sample size to draw any conclusions there. You know, still a pretty minuscule 3-point attempt rate, only 20% of his shots coming from three, which is pretty low for a guard. And, you know, if he can't shoot, you know, I think the idea is, all right, you've got him and you've got Drummond to run pick and roll, and then you're going to have shooters all around them, which seems to be the roster building idea at this point. And I like that, but, you know, like, what is he good at? Like, tell me what Reggie Jackson's amazing basketball skill is at this point. Like, his vision is, you know, I'd say probably a little bit below average for a point guard. He's got great, great length, but hasn't really shown that with his defensive effort so far. He has some potential, but he's also, you know, basically 25 now. He is 25. So, you know, he's getting to the point where we need to see some more results now. He can finish at the rim pretty well for a point guard, but he's not incredibly quick or anything. You know, probably a little bit above average athletically, but still not like unbelievable, not like a nuclear athlete. It's just, you know, I think his ceiling is maybe being like the 15th best point guard in the league.
Yeah, and he also, you talked about the idea of leverage. He has a very, very low qualifying offer. So, I mean, the leverage that they had was pretty low. That deal came out less than an hour after we'd recorded a podcast saying how we didn't see a team that was going to make him like a super high offer sheet. And that was true. We didn't miss anyone. The only thing that was there was that the Pistons would just basically bid up on themselves and do it. And That's disappointing to me just because I like Stan Van. I like some of what they've been building. As you said, the idea of Drummond and shooters. And this constricts what they can do not only right now, but in the next couple summers because they're paying him a lot of money. And if we're right on Reggie Jackson, it's not like they're going to have the ability, both in terms of space and in terms of trading, to really move on from him.
This, to me, is interesting. It kind of shows the value of anchoring, which for people who are not familiar with that concept, basically the idea is that in negotiations, where you start or if there is some sort of a figure that exists, that can then be a basis for negotiations just simply on the basis that it's out there and it's in people's minds. So like look at that, you know, Reggie Jackson turned down a 4-year, $48 million extension with Oklahoma City, which looks like a fantastic idea because he got 5 for 80 and now he gets to be the starting point guard in Detroit too, right? So definitely made the right decision there. But, you know, we talked about, oh, it should end up at 12.5, maybe 13.5, something like that. I mean, I think that's more like what the market would have dictated, you know, if you were really on the open market. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, we're on the same page.
Yeah, although, you know, you could say there is still a ton of space around the league and, you know, at least he's young, you know, he's a better risk to take it on than some of these other guys. But nonetheless, I think that's about, what the, you know, a point guard of his skills, already 25, should be getting. But because he had turned down that deal, there was kind of this idea that he wasn't going to take it. He wasn't going to take less than that now that he's traded to Detroit and he's the starter and they're going to take care of him. You know, and Detroit kind of had to know, all right, he's not going to take this. We got to do way better than this. I think it made a big difference just having it known that he rejected that. If they offered him the same thing, you know, it just wasn't going to be enough. And it didn't seem like it was enough because now he's traded to Detroit and he's a starting point guard, capital letters. So maybe that's what happened there. And maybe they just said, hey, look, we can't even give away our money in free agency this year. We got turned down by Damari Carroll. We used the rest of our space on a salary dump from Phoenix. What else are we going to use our money on? We might as well just keep this guy happy. And pretty amazing, too, for Detroit. I mean, if you look at their books, they did the salary dump from Phoenix. They had to use $5 million on Aaron Baines. They overpaid Reggie Jackson. And they still have, you know, $5 million a year, whatever it is, from Josh Smith that they stretched. And they still have, like, and now they just paid Joel Anthony $2.5 million for this year. So if that's, I mean, maybe you can say that they're not doing a great job of finding bargains, but maybe it's also true that they just can't get anybody to take their money.
Yeah, and if a team like the Warriors wasn't willing to give up an asset to dump David Lee, I mean, then you're really you can't even if they're limited in using it to extract resources as well, then that's a limitation as well.
All right, let's move on to the next one here. You have been trumpeting Corey Joseph for quite some time.
You've overstated that.
What'd you say?
You've overstated that. I liked Corey Joseph. What he got is a little bit different.
Well, that was going to be my question to you is, was that enough to kind of make you blanch a little bit on that, to say this might be a little bit too much? 4 years, $30 million with Toronto, with a player option in the final year to return home to Canada from Masai Ujiri.
Well, yes, it was. I think they paid him, again, this is paralleling Reggie Jackson, they paid him for his ceiling and not for his expected value. And especially when he had become one of the dynamics that shifted is he became an unrestricted free agent during the moratorium because of what happened with the Spurs. And I feel like he might have gotten, you know, he might have gotten more money in some ways than he deserved. But this point guard market is the single craziest thing that I can remember. And that's, you know, think about things, because you see Corey Joseph get that kind of money, but then you see Mo Williams, Jeremy Lin, guys like that, which are, you know, maybe they don't have the future that those guys have, or even Patrick Beverley. Patrick Beverley got substantially less money, has a non-guaranteed last year, as opposed to Corey Joseph, who has a player option. It's insane.
Yeah, no, that's true. I didn't realize Beverley's last year was non-guaranteed. I hadn't seen that.
Yeah, but it's like $5 million non-guaranteed because Daryl Morey is a wizard.
Well, so as our resident Corey Joseph fan, what does he really do that well? I think he's a very good defensive point guard, but other than that, he hasn't shown a lot, despite the fact that he's, you know, he is only 23, so there's room for growth there from an age perspective, but not a ton of skills offensively that I've seen so far.
Right. My big concern with him is very similar. I just talked about Patrick Beverley in that I don't see him as a guy who you can rely on to run your offense. I like him as a defensive player. That's why I liked him a lot as a kind of a second point guard or a third guard, is because you can afford a little bit less of that. I feel like he has some potential to get better as a pick and roll player. His instincts on offense don't seem terrible, but I haven't seen enough from him to say, you know, like, oh, you can, in two or three years, you can plug him in and he'll be able to, you know, if Kyle Lowry gets hurt, he can be the guy who carries a successful Raptors offense. I don't see that. I just saw a guy who, when you're seeing that, you know, the market for second and third guards, I'm like, hey, he's as good as any of these guys. And I didn't see any offer like this coming. It was more that I thought he was being underappreciated than that I thought he was great.
I will say this for Masai. He decided he was not messing around with their perimeter defense anymore. Right? Like, they got rid of Lou Williams, didn't make him any offer at all, according to an interview that he did with Basketball Insider's Alex Kennedy. And then they traded away Grievous in what was a heist of a trade to Milwaukee. They drafted DeLon Wright, who's a really good defender. Also 23, kind of a similar profile to Corey Joseph, frankly, in terms of what he brings. Maybe a little bit better of a passer, but aside from that, kind of somewhat similar skills. They got Corey Joseph. Kyle Lowry can still defend when he's motivated. He won't have to play nearly as many minutes now, the hope would be, with those guys coming off the bench. And of course, they spent big for Jamari Carroll now, who's another real good defender on the wing. So I think they have now decided we're just going to be better with our perimeter defense. Although when you say that it's going to be Valanciunas playing a ton of minutes now, and they got rid of Amir Johnson, don't really have much in the way of power forwards on the roster. I mean, maybe Caboclo can start to give him some minutes, although I doubt it. He's probably still another year away from being 2 years away, as Fran Fraschilla would say. But, you know, I think that there is a little bit of a remake going on here. I'm not sure that they're really any better than they were last year, though, when it really gets down to it.
I'm not sure they are either, but with where they were, that's not the worst thing in the world. You know, if they can be in that second tier, especially with the Hawks probably coming back to earth a little bit, I think that's a relatively solid place to be, and I think they have a more firm foundation. Even if they didn't get better, they have a more firm foundation than they did, and that's worth something.
Yeah, I agree. But you think that's an overpay, though?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's an overpay, especially when you consider where the market for non-starting guards has gone now.
I guess that's true. Like you think about
what you're getting from Corey Joseph, especially because of that player option on the fourth year. So if you think about it, that you're getting a 3 year thing, you know, I don't think that his ceiling, you know, being there, he's probably not going to start for them in the next couple of years. And maybe, you know, you hope that he's a bargain in that third year, but if so, then he's gone. You know, if things work out, then he's gone. You have full bird rights, which is nice, but, and he's from there, so you hope that you can get him back, but that's a really, really hopeful, you know, hopeful situation for them.
What we're seeing too is that a lot of these deals for younger guys are getting longer deals more than ever before, even if they themselves are not really that great yet. Guys like Aminu, Corey Joseph, you know, Ed Davis is 26, but another guy who's getting a huge raise. And the reason for that is because with the cap going up so much, you want guys who are at least have the potential to become bargains once that occurs. So that's kind of the reasoning there, and I totally understand it. And you're seeing that, like, the real veteran guys, you know, as you mentioned, Jeremy Lin, although he's still only 26, I think people are kind of done with him from an upside perspective. Mo Williams, obviously older, those type of guys, Lou Williams, to, you know, those guys who's 28, those guys are not really getting the type of numbers that you might have expected with more of the money going to these young guys. So, all right, let's see what else we got here. The Spurs Borg, as Zach Lowe likes to call them. I like to call them the Jedi, because they seem to have performed this mind trick on all their players. Maybe that's too derogatory, because they seem to have just gotten this great atmosphere there. But David West to the Spurs for the minimum gave up essentially $11 million by opting out with the Spurs, and he put his money where his mouth is. I can't remember the last time someone took that big of a haircut to go play for a winner since Karl Malone went to the Lakers in 2003 for just the straight-up veterans minimum, when I'm sure he could have re-signed in Utah for like $20 million a year or something.
And I thought about Kirilenko too, but Kirilenko didn't take this type of reduction. And West also reportedly turned down more money from the Warriors and the Wizards to take the minimum with the Spurs.
Yeah, and that makes sense though, because he'll, at the very least, they play their backup bigs a lot. He'll be either the third or fourth big there, depending on probably what night it is, frankly, whether it's, is it going to be DR or him? Won't have to play a ton in the regular season, but definitely will be able to contribute to a championship level team. So I get it. And then Manu Ginobili coming back with the room exception, 2 years, I think the second year, a player option on that. But I tweeted this out this morning. I hope people understand just how amazingly awesome of an offseason this has been for the Spurs. And you can fill in here if I miss anything, but here's all the things that had to just go perfectly right. Number one, convince Tim Duncan and Manu Ginobili to come back. Number two, convinced Tim Duncan to take, oh, I don't know, maybe about $15 million less than his market value.
Yeah.
No problem. Convinced Manu Ginobili to take maybe, you know, $2-3 million less than his market value. No problem. And, oh, hey, do you guys mind waiting until, or you guys mind signing first so we can do all this other stuff? No problem. Kawhi Leonard, full 5-year max. You know, we'll give you a player option on the fifth year, but, you know, you're young, doesn't matter. Commit to coming back right away, but don't sign until after everyone else does so we can use your low cap hold. Danny Green, how about you take a good $20 million or so below your market value over the next 4 years to come back in a 4-year, $45 million deal? And could you, if you can wait to sign until after we sign these other guys too so we can use your low cap hold, that'd be great. LaMarcus Aldridge, how about you leave Portland where you've been for 9 years, spurn the Lakers, spurn the Mavs, spurn Phoenix, and come here. How about that? Yeah, sure. All that. No problem.
Like, and unloading Tiago Splitter.
Yeah, that's right. That was another one, too. They just were able to unload him in the cat space. Although he's a valuable player. That's probably actually, you know, the least impressive, but still pretty good, right? So pretty remarkable performance by the Spurs front office to make this work out. And in a way, it seems like it was all predestined, and I'm sure it was. They probably had this all done. But, you know, the foundation for this was sown years and years and years before by their organizational culture and, you know, a team. Think of the teams that weren't able to get guys to do stuff like this. You know, like the Hawks, who weren't able to get it done to get their guys to take less. You know, Damari Carroll is someone who, you know, wouldn't come back for the early bird. Paul Millsap wanted, Carroll wouldn't come back for, you know, the $11 million or so that they could pay him. Paul Millsap wanted his max. That's actually another interesting thing, too, if you think about it. They probably could have actually, if Millsap would have just taken that 16.6 to start, they could have paid Carroll, like, maybe almost $14 million. Now, with where the cap really ended up, they could have come close to matching that Toronto deal if Paul Millsap had been willing to fit into the early bird exception at $16.6 million. Which he was not, and that then really torpedoed any chance of Carroll's coming back. So the Spurs just have this advantage over everyone else that their culture has created. Oh, and then they got David West to give up $11 million and come there for the minimum, too. Let's not forget that.
And they also were able to, while we talked about that Splitter is obviously a better asset than a lot of the other guys that have been traded to clear cap space for a star player, they were able to do that while retaining all draft assets and Patty Mills, who was a nice depth piece for them, yeah. which allowed them to let Corey Joseph go. I mean, you think about that, while they're going to be getting minimum salary guys for more spots than a lot of other teams, and they already got, you know, a quality player for one, they were able to retain a couple of the other players that make them so good, and they were able to keep Green and Kawhi, they're young guys, so they didn't have to sacrifice anything other than, if you want to say, the margin between Tiago Splitter and Boris Diaw, which is really the only difference between what happened with them. Well, and we weren't unrealistic enough to give them David West.
Yeah. All right, enough on the Spurs. We'll be talking about them plenty for the next year, I'm sure. Mo Williams, 2 years, $4.3 million, part of the mini mid-level exception. They still have about $1 million of that left. And that's actually useful because they may give some of it to their second round draft pick, Rakeem Christmas. And the reason that's important is we could say, oh yeah, he's a second round draft pick. They'll just give him the minimum salary. That's true. You can start him at the minimum salary, but the minimum salary exception only applies to contracts that are 2 years. So if they wanted to sign him for longer than 2 years, even if it's for the minimum salary, they have to use either cap space, which obviously they don't have, or part of an exception to do it. So I would expect that they would use that to sign Christmas and try to get another potential low-cost guy under contract. We'll see what happens. Maybe they aren't even that impressed with him and they don't do that, but it now gives them that option to leave a little bit of that mid-level. Or they also have the option to go slightly above a veteran's minimum for someone else. Although the veteran's minimum is pretty much the same as that amount that's left of the mini mid-levels. That doesn't provide much. But that's just a small nuance there. But that's a great get for Cleveland, right?
Yeah, it is. And Mo Williams is somebody who can, you know, who can get offense. And people have talked about that you want to have a defender kind of at the backup point guard position. And I don't think this precludes them from bringing back Dellavedova. It's just a roster spot issue. And I think that if when you have a team that has a point guard that can deal with injury concerns, I think Mo Williams brings you more as a Kyrie replacement for those stretches, should they happen, than a guy like Dellavedova would.
Yeah, that's right. And they're going to probably need all three of those guys next year anyway, because Kyrie, I would imagine, is not going to be playing more than 30 minutes a game after with his health issues. So good sign there. Jeremy Lin, 2 years, $4 million, likely the biannual exception. There's been speculation that the second year is a player option. I haven't seen that confirmed yet anywhere. Have you?
I have not.
That's to Charlotte, by the way.
Yeah, to the Hornets. And it was shocking to me because I could see Lin taking a deal like that. I mean, he just got paid a bunch of money from a deal that was originally the Rockets, and of course he was on the Lakers. But he's not going to a team, incidentally, like Dallas, where he's clearly going to get a bunch of playing time. I mean, presumably they'll play him next to Kemba Walker at least a little bit, and he can, you know, if Kemba gets hurt, he can take on a larger role. But to me, when you want to get that shine, when you want to do a make-good deal, you pick the best possible situation, and you work from there.
I do think there are some conditions there for him to be successful. They have a lot more shooting on the roster. Frank Kaminsky looks like he's going to be a lights-out shooter in summer league so far. You know, it's only summer league, but he can at least add some shooting around. Al Jefferson, not a great pick-and-roll partner, but I think a lot of the minutes that Lin plays, he'll be out of the game. And they've got more shooting now on the wing with Batum. So, you know, there might be some opportunity for him to run pick and roll. That's really all he's good at offensively, but he's pretty good at it. Not a great spot-up shooter, an off-the-ball guy. But you're right, it doesn't – if you're trying to rehab your value, I mean, I thought when I saw him go there, I'm like, okay, he's probably getting the full MLE. That's why he went there, right? It really surprises me that there wasn't another team out there that was willing to beat that offer. Like, why wouldn't the Bulls pay him more than that, right?
Or the Sixers?
Maybe.
Because then they could trade him at the deadline.
Yeah, maybe that's true, too. And just give those big guys, you know, someone to play pick and roll with a little bit, someone to distribute. But, yeah, it's really – there's a lot of teams that I feel like could have used him and – he's not bad, you know. I mean, I think he's at least someone who can run pick and roll on your second unit pretty well. So he's better by far, I think, better than Aaron Brooks, you know, going back to Chicago. And there's plenty of other teams too. You know, I mean, I think he wasn't willing to wait on the Mavs, but he certainly could have gone there potentially as well, even now with the DeAndre Jordan thing having leaked out. So, yeah, I really don't quite understand this. I don't see him rehabbing his value particularly well there. I mean, he might even lose playing time to Brian Roberts a little bit when they decide they need more shooting on the floor. So it's a little bit of a head-scratcher for me. I mean, I think he does have the player option, but I just don't see him having some unbelievable year. And, it must mean that just his market wasn't that good, right?
It has to. I mean, there's no other rational reason for it. It's not like it's a hometown discount or anything like that. You know, whenever I see a contract that is strange, I start to look at things like that. That's how I found out Brandon Wright was from Tennessee. But there isn't anything like that with Jeremy.
Yeah, and, you know, the Lakers, everyone who played on the Lakers last year other than Ed Davis is getting, like, zero interest whatsoever. I mean, I know that they were, like, a pretty toxic team. They still didn't have a horrible offense last year. You know, like, guys like Boozer and Lin had okay seasons off the bench. Granted, they're not any great shakes defensively. The Lakers were pretty bad on defense overall. But, you know, I think those guys still deserve above minimum contracts. And in Lin's case, when you consider how many teams still need backup point guards and what's out there, at least as far as guys who were in the NBA last year, I would have paid more for them.
He got 1/20th of what Reggie Jackson's going to get paid.
Yes.
Yes.
Allen Anderson to Washington. I really like this one. 1 year, $4 million deal, using up most of their mid-level exception. And we don't have to spend too long on this, but he gives them another decent 3-and-D option. A little bit older, but, you know, can just as someone who won't kill you off the bench as a wing guy, Short-term deal keeps their 2016 space open. Totally like it.
Yep, and it aligns the, you know, between this and Jared Dudley, gave them pieces that add to their depth this year without sacrificing anything long-term.
We'll blow through some of the rest of these here. Omri Caspi back to the Kings. 2 years, $6 million, probably the room exception-ish. You would also imagine that would come with a player option for next year, although I don't think that's actually been reported. That just would be, is my assumption that these types of deals have had. I think that's pretty good. Caspi quietly shot pretty well from three-point range last year, has done well as a small ball four. I think he will get more playing time than people think he might, despite the fact that the Kings basically have two other power forwards who are basically centers in Kufos and Cauley-Stein. George Karl has not been a play-two-bigs type of guy throughout a lot of his career. He's liked to go small, and Caspi now gives them that option. With Rudy Gay, they can also do some more switching on the perimeter, which I think they'll appreciate. So, you know, Caspi, that's probably the first Kings contract that I really like this year.
Yeah, and he did well under Karl during that stretch of the year, so I think that it's a nice fit. I think that he's one of the few pieces that makes sense with DeMarcus Cousins, so kudos.
KG is going back to Minnesota 2 years, which is surprising to some, perhaps. So that'll actually put him, I think, as the only guy other than, like, Robert, or I don't know whether it's Kareem or, like, Kevin Willis to play, more than, like, 21 seasons. I don't know. I shouldn't quote this because I don't remember what it is, so never mind. But he'll have played a lot of years, top 2, 3, 4 all time. If he finishes out that contract, we don't know what the terms are. What do you think they'll be?
I was going to ask you, is there any number that would surprise you? Like, if they gave him $10 million, considering the parties involved.
Anything that put them into the luxury tax would surprise
you. Yeah, I guess that's where the line is.
I forget where they are exactly right now. There was never talk of them being a cap team, you know, as an under the cap team. And they've used most of their MLE on Pielitsa. Actually, only 3 years, $11 million for him, so they didn't have to use their full MLE on him. I think that's going to end up being a total steal of a contract. It shows you the leverage. I mean, he's the EuroLeague MVP last year.
Yep.
It shows you the leverage that having a draft pick rights on someone can still give you, even though, you know, he's 27 years old and they weren't bound by the rookie scale anymore since they had drafted him more than 3 years earlier.
So without Bielitsa, I have them at $18 million under the luxury, under the new luxury tax, 18.7 actually. And so if you add him in, you know, something in the 15 range. So if you could give, theoretically, I'm not saying they did this, but you could give him $10 million and still be clear.
Yeah, it wouldn't shock me if they did that, actually.
It wouldn't. It really wouldn't.
To make it worth his while to stick around and just be a mentor, I wouldn't expect that it would be less than like $7 million. But we'll see. I don't know. It'll be interesting. Maybe we're both way off. Who knows? And KG, by the way, has already made the most money of anyone in NBA history.
Right. You can go through a couple of them quickly. Sonny Weems returns to the United States to play 2 years with the Phoenix Suns at the room exception.
Yeah, I thought we would see so much more of a European influx. He played the last 2 years with Žalgiris, I think. In Lithuania, and then with Cheska Moscow the last 2 years. Real good player for them. Still an athletic wing at 29, slowing down slightly there, but can make three-pointers reasonably well, can get up and down in transition. Think of him as kind of like, you know, maybe a Corey Brewer type, not as intense defensively, but, you know, a little better shooter, maybe even a little bit more athletic, jumping off 1 foot and trying to dunk on people. So, yeah, I love that signing for Phoenix, right? Like, this is another one of these ones where it's like, you know, why not go into the European market now? Because really, other than the fact that, you know, maybe 90% of the top 100 players in the world are in the NBA, once you get below that, the highest European players and the NBA start to get a lot more similar.
Yeah, they
so,
do.
And you might as well bring guys over who just don't have the track record. I mean, he did play for Toronto for a time, but didn't do much there. You know, he's someone who's blossomed. I mean, guys who are in the NBA, 23, 24-year-olds, who, you know, don't look like they're going to be anything. I mean, look at like Damari Carroll, who thought he was going to be any good, you know, 3 years ago. And now he got a $50 million a year contract. Well, guys can blossom in the same fashion when they're overseas too. And I think that especially now with the cap rising and teams having more room than they know what to do with, looking at those types of avenues and finding a guy who can fit pretty well with your team, that's going to be an advantage to teams that are actually able to do that. And it, so I like this one for Phoenix.
I do too. We already talked a little bit about it. Wesley Johnson signed 1 year minimum for the Clippers, especially with the DeAndre Jordan news. I really like that for them.
Yeah, it seemed like it was just shuffling deck chairs on the Titanic before DeAndre came back, but now it's another guy who can help him play small and, you know, at least a more athletic guy. I like him better than some of the guys that they tried to sign last year to veterans minimums. And, you know, at least someone who has been an effective NBA rotation player. He did, of course, continue the meme if he had like one good game against Doc in April. So he signed him. But nonetheless, I still like it. Okay. Joe Ingles going back to the Jazz. 2 years, $4.5 million. He is 28. Shot the ball better from three in the second half of the year. He is not someone who's going to finish at the rim at all, but does move the ball quickly. You know, because offensive value is kind of dependent on whether he can hit shots or not. But, you know, he will penetrate and kind of, you know, just loll into the lane and throw another kick out pass to kind of just keep the ball moving around and maybe open up a three-pointer in kind of that European style, you know, which he played for so long with Maccabi. And also just a mentor to Dante Exum. He and Exum are pretty close from the Australian national team. He was actually Exum's idol growing up. So it makes sense they want to bring him back. Not a huge cost. I mean, maybe a slight overpay when you consider that he was restricted, but, you know, it, not going to kill you and a great locker room guy. I think the Jazz are really focused a lot on maintaining the chemistry of last year's group that they felt was really special. So Ingles, I think, was a part of that.
He definitely was. And going to your hometown, Aaron Brooks, back to Chicago. From what I recall, this is they're signing him with non-Bird, right? They're not good dipping into their MLE.
Yes, they. I don't think they are. Yeah, it's just. I didn't see it reported, but then I saw that Eric Pincus had it down basically for the minimum again. So it probably is.
Just, so they could just sign him with the minimum. That's true. They wouldn't even need.
No,
him.
I think it's just the minimum exception. And that's fine. I mean, he had some moments last year. He did have some unsustainably hot shooting, both from three and kind of on his little tough hooks that he could convert, you know, in the 3 to 9 foot range. And he was horrible in the playoffs. I still think they need a better option there to compete with him, potentially, because Kirk Heinrich is about done. And hey, you know what? If the Bulls hadn't signed Heinrich, they might have actually been able to get to the point where they could have at least avoided the tax or used the full MLE, they might even consider at this point stretching Heinrich. Although if they don't sign someone else to replace, you know, to potentially replace him at backup point guard, maybe that doesn't matter. They also have Etwan Moore who can play that position adequately. It's not impossible to me that he could actually become the best of those three options as time goes on. But that's a somewhat of a depressing thought for a big market team with considering the fact that the tax has gone up so much higher than was thought. I really think it's it would be a little bit of a disservice to Bulls fans if they do not spend some money on getting a better backup point guard option. Now, you know, it could be that the strategy is they leave open the MMLE, which could enable them to outbid anybody else for veteran buyout candidates the way that Houston was able to. With Josh Smith, they were able to use their biannual, which they hadn't used at all last year. So that is potentially a strategy there, but, you know, we'll see.
Yeah, we will see.
As we always do with the Bulls and money.
Yeah, and we also saw J.J. Barea returning to the Mavericks, so another point guard going back. It looks like it's going to be for the room exception, though now their circumstances are totally changed, so, you know, it could be a little bit different than that.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of remarkable. I mean, Lynn signed for less than that in Charlotte.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you rather have Lynn than Barea?
Or both?
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, they'll have plenty of room to sign whoever they want now, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Leandro Barbosa, 1 year, $2.5 million, using up a lot of the mini-mid level for the Warriors. this is kind of a, I think, kind of a sop to Coach Kerr, bringing him back. You know, he really liked him as a chemistry guy. Had a few moments during the season or in the playoffs, but overall, by advanced metrics, was not an effective player last year. I don't think provides enough shooting or defense, and I never liked him because he kind of takes them out of the switching that they can do on the perimeter.
Defensive but, specialist, you know, Leandro Barroso?
I would have thought he'd come back at the veterans minimum, that they wouldn't actually pay more than that for him.
Or, as Bobby Marks mentioned, they could have used their non-Bird, and I think they could have gotten him at about 1.7, and that would have then they would have opened up the mini-mid level, especially now with all the money they saved on David Lee. So, yeah, that's... It's a little bit disappointing in that sense, but they were really on a roster spot crunch. So it wasn't my favorite use of that money, but you won the title. He was a part of it. The players clearly really like him, so I'm not going to beat it too hard.
Yeah, and he still provides like a good veteran presence as well. You know, I think maybe what we'll see is that they'll try to upgrade with another shooter during the season by trading for him. Maybe that'll be the plan, as they kind of see how it's going. Jason Smith, in one of the more inexplicable deals to me, especially considered in the context of the fact that they let Kyle O'Quinn go for a four-year, $16 million deal to New York. 1 year, $4.5 million to Orlando. What for?
What, more importantly than that, what is Orlando saving their cap flexibility for? You know, like, if you think about that maybe their margins like that, we talked about how we love the O'Quinn contract and they basically gave him up for nothing. I think that Jason Smith is worse. He's older, and the main benefit is that they, you know, that they don't have to pay him for three more years like O'Quinn, but O'Quinn's an asset. It's another just surprising move by the Mets.
I mean, maybe they just felt that, like, kind of having all these young guys in the locker room who are eager for playing time, who are eager to kind of prove themselves, bringing in guys like CJ Watson, Smith, who kind of, you know, have sat on the end of the bench or getting paid their money, aren't going to complain. You know, maybe they felt like they just need that a little bit more, you know, but still, I mean, and then having another guy that Scott Skiles could potentially play at the four instead of playing Aaron Gordon there or Tobias Harris there. And, you know, forcing those guys into play on the wing more instead does not make a ton of sense to me. Another one, kind of a head-scratcher, Joel Anthony, 2 years, $5 million, second year, non-guaranteed. So I guess, you know, about $2.5 million this year. Who's paying him more than the minimum anywhere?
I don't know. I really don't know.
You know, a hard worker, good locker room guy. But, man, I mean, this is just Detroit just can't give their money away, I guess.
Well, they can.
Yeah, well.
And so another piece that actually dropped while we were recording this podcast is that the Spurs traded a second-round pick, which presumably will be their own at some point, for Sacramento guard Ray McCallum, who I was pretty high on at the draft, and he hasn't shown a ton during the season. But, hey, I mean, their second-round picks aren't the most valuable thing in the world.
Yeah. That's true. Scola going to Toronto. We found that out is 1 year, $3 million.
Yes.
Not bad. You know, Scola kind of fits in with the foreign feeling there a little bit. You know, a good leader. Actually is the guy that the Pacers coaches would always point to as the best at verticality, even more so than Roy Hibbert. So maybe he can, Jonas Valanciunas can learn a little bit from him. And then Justin Holiday going to Atlanta, not sure how much that is. I would imagine it is for the minimum. Usually when they don't say what it's for, that's what it is, and that's also probably what his value is. But you would imagine at least it's guaranteed.
So now we can look at quickly who is still left on the market. In terms of bigs, you have Enes Kanter is the only starter quality guy. And then in the non-starters, you have a kind of a compelling group. To me, the guys that are interesting are Josh Smith, who I think a lot of people expect will still go to the Rockets on part of their mid-level exception, and Kevin Serafin, who becomes an option for the Dallas Mavericks.
Yeah, that's one. I actually could see Smith going to the Mavs. That wouldn't shock me, and he could kind of play almost like a center type of role for them and run pick and roll there. Amari Stoudemire can still get you some buckets. Teletovic is really the only restricted free agent who's out there. On the wing, that many people gone still. You know, there's still JR out there. I still ultimately expect that he'll return to Cleveland. Apparently the sticking point there is the years. but I don't think anybody's really been willing to offer him 3 years. And so if that becomes the case, maybe he'll go back to Cleveland for less than that. McDaniels, as the restricted free agent option, is out there still, but, you know, pickings are pretty slim after that. And then really bad in the point guard market, it's Jameer Nelson and then Dellavedova, Norris Cole, and Jason Terry is about that. And with the reporting that, like, Sergio Rodriguez, Marcelino Huertas are wanting to come over from Europe this year, like, why aren't teams who need backup point guards looking at those guys? You know, that would be another one for the Bulls. Sergio Rodriguez, I think, would be excellent for what they need and a good fit in Fred Hoiberg's new system. You got a lot of teams that could use someone like those guys, who I think are much better options than pretty much anyone else left on the board, maybe except for Jameer Nelson.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's such slim pickings, and those guys have a track record. It's not even like you have the whole situation of, oh, we don't know how they're going to translate. Those guys have been over here.
Yeah, and maybe they, well, Huertas hasn't, but Rodriguez
Oh, yeah, you're
has.
Right. Huertas hasn't.
He,
I was,
yeah. He looked okay at times in his box score stats, but, you know, was a little bit of a prima donna when he was here, I think, was his kind of his reputation. But, no, I mean, he's matured so well at Real Madrid. I mean, he's the best point guard in Europe probably right now, so... I think he's someone that you could bring over for sure. So let's go into the preview now of whatever's left. Atlanta still the room exception. Brooklyn, to correct an error that I had before, Tim Bontemps told me this, that Thomas Robinson actually signed for a 2-year $2.2 million. I think the second year is his option. So that means they still have about $2.2 million of the mini mid-level left. Boston is likely done, may have the room exception left still. Bulls have the mini mid-level. Cleveland, about $1.4 million left of the mini mid-level, and they still have that Haywood contract that it doesn't look like they're really going to find a taker for at this point, does it?
Oh, I'm sure they'll find something.
Yeah, I mean, maybe they'll do that deal for Crawford, give the Clippers a little more flexibility, but Haywood, I think, becomes guaranteed on August 1st, so... wherever you're going to trade him to, it has to happen before then so they can waive him and get the salary relief.
Right.
Charlotte, I think, still has their full MLE. It sounds like it's the BAE for Lynn. Dallas, sadly, now $20 million in space. Who the heck do they use that on? I don't know. Denver, still $10 million. Hasn't signed anyone yet. Detroit, I have a few million left. Golden State, about $900K of their MLE. They could maybe use that to sign someone to a longer deal, you know, who just makes a team out of camp or someone off the D League team if they want to go for a 3-year minimum deal for someone like that. They could use what's left of the MMLE for that because they can't sign to more than 2 years, as I said, if they just use the minimum contract exception. Houston has the MLE. Indiana still has about $10 million in the market for some big guys for sure. Miles Turner, by the way, has looked awesome in summer league. Clippers are down to minimums. Lakers down to minimums, assuming Bass goes for the room exception. They might be able to carve out a bit more now that the cap's higher. Memphis is done, except for minimums. Miami has their mini mid-level. They're supposedly meeting with Amari Stoudemire. Might be a decent get for them, with a little bit of that. They're reportedly trying to move Chalmers and Chris Anderson, which would save them a ton of money, and basically willing to move them for free. Chris Anderson is someone who I might still, as a fourth big, might still have something left. They could take a flyer on him. And maybe he's the type of guy who you just take him if you're a bad team, let him play 15 minutes a game. If he looks okay, then you can move him for a second rounder at the deadline for a team that suffers an injury in the front court and needs a little bit of help. New Orleans... about $2 million of their MLE, and they still have the BAE. Oh, and Milwaukee still has that $5 million after they traded away Jared Dudley, maybe more like $6 million now at the cap being further up.
And then, so you have the Knicks, who still have the room exception. The Thunder have the mini mid-level, and they still have to figure out with Kanter.
Probably won't use the mini mid-level.
I wouldn't think so.
And the fact that they have just a crap load of guys in their roster already.
They already do. Orlando has about $13 million?
No. I forgot to update that. I think now that they signed Smith, they're down to like, in the mid, $6-5 million, something like that.
Woo! Great use of their money. Philly's about $20 million, but they probably kicked up a little bit with the cap increase, like 20, maybe 21.
Yeah, and that's if they waive some nine guarantees. Yeah, they keep those guys around there more.
They have plenty of them.
Yeah,
Suns about $9 million. Blazers still talked about. They have the war chest, about $30 million. Spurs, we've talked about plenty. You know, they really, it's minimums from here on out.
Yeah, it looks like Duncan's going to make about $7 million next year.
Sacramento has the room mid-level because but that's Caspi, right?
Yeah, no. So yeah, I think they're pretty much done now. Maybe they can fit him in with the cap being higher, or they'll just have to distribute their other commitments. I saw actually Mark Spears said it's a $10 million contract for Rondo that he's going to sign rather than 9.5. So maybe some of that increase in the cap is going to go to him.
Woo, great for them. Makes that great, excellent contract even better. Toronto has about $4 million.
Yeah, I think that's right still.
Yeah.
I think they pretty much used all that up.
Oh, and Scola. That's right.
So, yeah. So, I think they're going to be done. They used the room MLE on Biombo. So, yeah, I think Toronto's done except for the minimums now. Utah's got 8 if they wanted to move on from Booker, which I think would be an utter shock if they did that at this point. They could get to 13. And then Washington has $1.4 million left of the MLE after using $4 million of it on Anderson. And then they have their BAE as well.
I think they used the BAE on Neil, actually.
Oh, thank you. Yes, they did.
There we go.
That's I will delete that from the sheet. All right. After that incredibly exciting listing of a bunch of numbers, it's probably time to sign off. Sorry we were unable to join you for the last 2 days. I'm going to Summer League tomorrow. I'm going to be in Utah. And then Danny and I will both be in Vegas. We'll try to give you some podcasts there, probably mostly Summer League focused, and you know, we'll hit some of the news, but maybe not as hard as we have been lately with a lot of the big stuff done now. I mean, we may see some really interesting sign and trades and stuff of that ilk come out now that all the transactions are officially legal, as they were around 9 o'clock Pacific, at 9 o'clock Pacific today. So we'll see what the future brings, but we'll at the very least have some good Summer League talk and, that'll be about it for today. So for Danny LaRue, I'm Nate Duncan. We'll catch you all next time.